Accession number 32297, reel 19.
John Dixon, reel 19.
Right, so I'm sitting on this accelerator for the very first time. As I say, there's nothing in front of you except open sea. Even more frightening at night, but we're not talking about that now. But you're sitting there, there's just you. Okay, you've probably got your crew behind you. And then behind them, there's 1,500 men in the ship's company, and you're sitting, you're Joe, out front. And you think, what am I doing here? And you really haven't got an awful lot of control of what's going to happen next, because you're given the signal by the deck control officer to wind your engine up, and you've put it on full power. You've already set takeoff flat. You've trimmed the aircraft, and then you wedge your right elbow into your side like this to save you snatching the stick back when the jerk comes, because you don't want to pull the stick back. So you just wedge it so that you can't move it. You've tightened the throttle nut. There's a tension nut on the throttle so that will not slip back. There you are. In today's world, of course, all this is done automatically. The pilot doesn't even have his hands on the controls, I don't think. But in these days, you had to obviously control the aircraft. And then at the crucial moment, he drops the flag, and whoosh, and away you go. I said I made a complete nonsense of the first time I went, because on a normal takeoff, you run the engine up full, and you're holding the aircraft on the brakes, and then when the time comes to go, you release the brakes and off you go. But of course, Dixon, being on the catapult and being scared, got his brakes on and he didn't release them. so there was, when I went off, I mean, I wasn't aware of it, of course, but there must have been a terrible smell of burning rubber, because I went off with the brakes on. It didn't stop the aeroplane, because the thrust of the hydraulic catapult would overcome anything like that, but I don't think I did the tires any good. And it wasn't until I was airborne that I realised I'd still got... I don't think I've told many people that story.
Once you're off the catapult, does the plane dip at all?
Well, it's the tail is slightly raised. Not on a Barracuda. I don't think it did. No, I think it took off in a sort of normal 3-point attitude. But once you were off the end of the deck and you'd recovered your consciousness, as it were, you had to move a bit quick to get the undercarriage up and get things back to normal, as it were. And by this time, Bambi, my observer, was yakking away. Tell him to shut up. I was busy. But there we are. And that's the second way of getting off. And there's a third way, and that's using RATOG, rocket assisted takeoff. And Barracudas, we had this. We didn't have it until we got out to the Far East, when they realized that Barracudas didn't fly very well in the hot weather. Their performance fell even worse than it was before. So we needed some way of boosting us off the deck with a useful load. I mean, you could still get off the deck, but you wouldn't be able to take much in the way of armaments with you. So they got these rocket-assisted takeoff things, and it was hilarious, because they didn't always work. And I mean, all it was. If you can imagine the chassis of a child's pram, and these were bolted onto each side of the aircraft, really just skeleton things, almost like a bobsleigh or something, were stuck on the side of the aircraft, and bolted onto that were these rockets. They were about 3 feet long, I suppose. Yeah, about 3 feet long, like a concrete pipe. I suppose they might even have been asbestos. I, I, I don't know, but just a blooming great pipe was stuck, one on each side, and then they were triggered off electronically. These were the rockets, you see. So how were they going to get this wired up? So, oh, well, there's no problem, they said, we can soon do that. So they bored a little hole through the side of the fuselage, just below the pilot's seat, and they led a wire through from this rocket outside, a bit of wire, and they led it through, and it was then wired onto the throttle or somewhere like that. I think I'm confusing it. That wasn't the actual firing wire. That was somehow done internally, I think. There was some way. But the wire that they led through was the jettison wire. That's right, memory fades, doesn't it? But there were these two blooming great rockets, and the idea, of course, was quite straightforward. You took off in the normal way, and when you got the tail up and you were about alongside the island, if you were on the ship, you pressed the button, and hopefully both these rockets went off. And the plane, because of the way the angle that they were set, it just lifted you vertically into the air, not more than about 20 feet probably. And they fired for 5 seconds, I don't know, not long, before they'd expired, by which time you hopefully had got proper flying speed, and that was fine. So there were five outcomes to using these rockets. Number one was that it worked, you were airborne. You flew around until you were not over any friendly ships, and then these bits of wire that came through the cockpit were like cheese wire with little toggles on the end. You tugged them, and that extracted a split pin in this funny sort of Bell's pram undercarriage thing and the whole thing fell off into the sea. And you did the other side, and that was it, and then away you went, and that was a complete success. So that was one. The other thing that could happen, and did on more than one occasion, was that you took off perfectly well, and then you pulled your little bits of wire, and the things wouldn't fall off. You couldn't jettison these rockets, and they weighed a ton. Well, a lot, they weighed a lot. So you couldn't get rid of them. So you had no option then but to land back on the ship with them on. But you couldn't do that until you jettisoned all your armament that you were carrying, if you were carrying bombs or whatever. You had to get rid of that. So complete waste of effort. So you jettisoned everything that was jettisonable, and then you landed back on with these blimmin' expired rockets still stuck to you. Never happened to me, but that was another way up. The third thing that could happen, of course, was that the port rocket fired and the starboard one didn't, whereupon you did a quick slow roll to the right, and more often than not ended up in the sea. If you roll to the right, the chances are that you could clobber the bridge with your starboard wing. I never saw it happen, but it did happen. And the other thing is, if the starboard rocket fired and the port one didn't, the same thing would happen the other way, and you'd spin into the sea on the port side, which is probably not quite so damaging because you were not likely to hit the island going that way. And then, of course, the fifth thing was neither of the rockets fired at all. And then it was a lap of the gods. I mean, if you were lucky, you might just have enough airspeed to stagger off and keep out of the water. But if not, you went for a swim ahead of the ship, which was not really the best place to go swimming. No, but none of this ever happened to me, and I don't remember it ever happening to any of my mates on my ship, although I've got a chum who did spin off a side and a swordfish doing this.
It seems a bit of a Heath Robinson.
Oh, it was completely Heath Robinson. Couldn't have been any other, could it? No, I mean, the fact that we'd got as far as Ceylon and somebody suddenly remembered that barracudas weren't much good in those sort of tropical climates, and the only way we were going to be effective was to have some form of rocket-assisted takeoff. Extraordinary, isn't it? But in the event, of course, we didn't really get to the point that we ever needed to use it in anger. But
on the fly deck, what's the kind of organisation of the control of the fly deck? Who does that, and how does it all work together? Because you mentioned, obviously, when you land on.
Yeah.
How does all the other bits work? Who takes you where? Who decides?
Well, there are different parties, of course. Each crew member of the ship's crew. These are all ship's crew people that basically control the engineering of the flight deck, and they've all got their own little groups, and they've got their own, usually an officer or a petty officer in charge of them. And they work very closely and in strict disciplines. I mean, in the shortest sense at all. I mean, there was always one or two bods kitted up in asbestos suits who were going to drag you out if there was a nasty accident. And there was always a crane driver, because we had a mobile crane called Jumbo. That was always parked just behind the island, and if a plane crashed, it quickly had to be moved. And so the Jumbo driver had to be quick off the mark, and they'd either move it, crane it up and take it up forward out of the way, or if the worst, they just push it and let it go over the side if they could, nothing else they could do with it. But they were sort of deck crew. And then, as I say, there were the chaps that unhooked the hook. There were the chaps that were in charge of the chocks. If when your aircraft was waiting to take off, it was all had chocked up. And when you were ready to go, these poor chaps had to pull the chocks away. And if there's a howling gale down the flight deck and it's pitching and rolling in nice windy, wet weather, it's not the best job to have. But they just basically lived in the little runways at the side of the flight deck, and that they rushed out from there and did their job. And then, of course, there were the people that worked the barrier. They had to be pretty skilled, and they were pretty clued up. There were people that worked the catapult. They were specialist engineers who did all those sort of things. And then going right back to the stern of the ship, the deck landing control officer, the batsman, he usually had two sailors with him immediately behind him, called tellers. They were called tellers. And he was concentrating entirely on bringing the aircraft into land. He had eyes for nothing else, so he just watched this plane completely. And one of the tellers, who was usually crouched by his feet somewhere, would be looking at the aircraft coming in to checking that it had got its flaps down and its hook down. And the chap that was just behind him would be checking the flight deck, so that once the barriers had come up again, ready for... He would say deck clear to the batsman, so that the batsman knew that he could safely bring the next plane on. If the deck was foul, in other words, there was a crash or the barrier hadn't come up again, he would say to the batsman, or would shout at him, presumably, foul deck or something like that, and the plane was sent round again, the batsman would send you round again. And if that happened to you as a pilot, as you took off, went round, you were looking down hoping that it wouldn't be too long before they got the deck clear, and you could land on and get a drink.
And were your ground crew also there to deal with the aircraft once you taxied?
Once you'd safely landed and you'd taxied, and they'd parked you wherever they wanted you, and it could have been up and forward, or as I say, on the lift or wherever, then your own ground crew took over, and you know, once you'd recovered your nerves, they asked you how you were, how the plane was.
And how are all these people identifiable on the day? Would they wear, I'm thinking of different colours. You mentioned obviously that the batsman would always wear a yellow.
Yeah.
Would other groups have different colours to identify them for what they're doing on the day?
Well, they certainly did in the post-war years. I can't truthfully remember too much about what we did in the war. They must have had some sort of identification. Yes, I mean, they wore like little waistcoats, and certainly in the post-war years they had different colours so that you knew which group they belonged to. But don't ask me to remember, I can't remember them all.
And with your ground crew, were they allocated specifically to you again? You mentioned that was the case while you were ashore.
Yeah, we always tried, it wasn't always possible, but it was always the aim that they were responsible for one aircraft. And you as pilot always hoped that you had your own aircraft. It wasn't always possible because, you know, the exigencies of working off a carrier, often you just had to take what was available. And my friend Peter Duper, I know you've talked to, when he was operating from Victorious, there was no question. They just used to go onto the deck, and he got into the first plane that was available. He often didn't know which plane it was, except that in the cockpit there would have been a call sign probably written up with which the number of it. But there was no question of having your own aircraft when you were operating under intense conditions like that. But that never happened to us. So we basically had our own aeroplane, which you flew all the time, unless it was being serviced or something was wrong with it, and then you had to take whatever was available.
And your ground crew were allocated to your aircraft? Who were they and what were their functions?
There was always one fitter and one rigger. The fitter looked after the engine. He was the engine man. And the rigger was basically looked after the airframe. And they were usually leading rates or even acting petty officers. They were fairly senior. And then they were the only two that were solely responsible for one aircraft. The other trades, such as radio, armourers, were shared. You didn't have one per aircraft. I mean, for example, an armourer might be responsible for, say, four aircraft, and a radio man might look after half a squadron because there was specialist work. But that's roughly how it worked. Then overall, there was a chief, was the line, what the Americans would call the line chief, who was the big fat boss of the whole outfit. And all the ground crews were responsible to him. They had to tell him if what needed repairing and if it was repairable or what.
So if you'd flown and there was some problem that occurred while you were flying, who would you tell? Would you tell your specific...
You'd tell the ground crew immediately, whether it was fitter or rigger or depending, or if it was an instrument problem, well, then they had to go and get somebody else. They did that, and then each aircraft had its own logbook. I think it was a Form 700. I think I may have mentioned it before. Before you took off, under normal conditions, when you're only sort of practicing, before you take off, you have this logbook, and it's all the columns are filled in, the fuel, and any faults corrected, and one of the crew will have initialed it as being fit to fly, and then you initial it as taking the aircraft on your responsibility. If when you land there's something wrong with it and something needs correcting, you make a note in that logbook, as well as telling somebody that something's not functioning correctly or whatever, and it's dealt with. And so when you next fly the plane, or whoever flies it next, can check that whatever's been reported as faulty has been mended.
And prior to takeoff, I take it you still, even on the carrier, you would do your pre-flight checks?
Yes. I say this with some hesitation, because a flight deck is not the most comfortable place to be wandering about around a whole load of aeroplanes, particularly if some of them have already got their propellers going, so you tend to keep a close eye on your aircraft when you're not actually flying it. In other words, if it's in the hangar or if it's ranged on deck, you always keep a close watch that things are as they should be, and then when you climb into it, obviously you do what you can visually, but you don't. I never used to walk around the whole plane and shake this and do that, because there wasn't the opportunity to do it. And this is going to lead me to another story, if you want to hear it now. Once we were safely aboard and we were becoming operational, one of the first trips we had to do was a navigation exercise, which was again the observer's main role, taking off from the ship and landing back on the ship when the ship was no longer where it was when we'd left it. So this was really the observer's responsibility. And the way this worked was that the pilots and the air gunners would go out and man the aircraft, while the observers stayed in their little briefing room, whatever it was called, I don't know, while they were given the latest up-to-date, what we would call SITREP today, situation report, as to everything that they needed to know about what we were supposed to be doing, where the ship was, where it was going to be, what speed the ship was doing, where the other ships were. All the information that the observer needed was concentrated into the last few minutes before takeoff, so that it was completely up to date. Now, by the time the observer had got all that gen in his little notebook, and he'd got this big canvas bag with his chart board and everything in it, all his tools, like a huge school satchel, they would all come out and climb into the aircraft, by which time we'd probably been told to start up. So there is a flight deck, and you imagine the picture, flight deck with, let's say, 12 barracudas, all with their propellers turning, all closely dovetailed in one to the other, and the wind's howling down the deck, and these poor wretched observers are coming out with these chart boards, which is like a sail anyway, and they're having to find their aircraft and climb in. Which, I mean, they all managed to do it, but it's not, I wouldn't have liked to have done it myself, not with a chart board around the neck and all this, and probably binoculars and all their paraphernalia. And I've got a cartoon I might show you of the same situation. Anyway, let's get on with the story. We've just recently joined the ship. We're going off, and this was basically an exercise for Bambi, my observer. And he climbs in, and all the propellers are going, and off we go. He then has to tell me which course to steer, and all this, that, and the other. Which we do. We have to find a wind. I don't know whether you want to hear about finding a wind, but when you're flying over the sea, particularly when you've got no reference to any land point or anything, you need to know exactly what the wind is doing. Okay, you've had a briefing, so you know what is anticipated, but as we all know, forecasts are often not exactly 100%. So once you've got settled down to your height that you're going to fly, the observer wants to know what wind is affecting you. So the way this is done, you carry a little smoke flare, and I'm not sure whether he released this or whether the pilot did, I can't remember, but he will release a smoke bomb or smoke flare, and on his stopwatch he knows exactly how long that will take to reach the water from the height that you're flying. When it hits the water on his stopwatch, he will say turn now, and the pilot then executes a turn, what we call a rate one turn, usually to port, so that you come round until you're flying exactly on the reciprocal course that you were flying before, so you're right going back parallel. You take 2 minutes to do the turn. It's a very gentle turn. You fly 1 minute in a straight line back there, and then he says turn again, always on his stopwatch, and you do another 2 minutes turn back here in the same direction, and then you fly another minute back up here. Now, it's quite easy to work out, isn't it? I can see you working it out. If there is no wind at all, where will you be? You will be exactly over the smoke flare because nothing's blown you off course. But of course there's always a wind. So at the precise moment that you would normally be over the smoke float, the observer takes a bearing on the smoke with his compass, and he also has to work out the distance, and I can't remember how he did that, but there was, so he knows that in the 6 minutes you've done this, you've moved so many miles in this direction. And that's the wind. And if you've moved a mile in 6 minutes, it's going to move 10 miles in an hour. So that's how they work out the wind. I find it fascinating. But the whole thing, of course, is completely governed by the accuracy that the pilot flies. He's got to maintain the exact height. He's got to take his time doing the exact turn. He's got to do his steer the exact course, so that the whole thing is worked out. It's good, isn't it? I don't know what they do today. They just press a button and do a GPS or something, don't they? But anyway, off we go and we do this whole exercise, and we are completely out of sight of any land or any ships for the best part of 2 hours. And we come back, and there's Bambi in the back saying we should see the fleet, because there was quite a few ships out. He'd say we should see the fleet in 3 minutes, 2 minutes, 1 minute or something. And I was pulling his leg, you see, because he could see nothing from the back. So I said, well, I can't really see much from there. I can't see, and I could see I was winding him up. Anyway, when he got to the exact point, he said we should be there now. So I then turned the aircraft onto its side and I said look down to port, and there was the ship. So it was absolutely a brilliant piece of navigating. His estimation went up my estimation of him went up tremendously in that short space. So we land and we all disappear into the bar for a drink. Bambi, by the way, never drank. He was teetotal, but he enjoyed the social life. So there am I, telling all my chums, I've got a brilliant navigator, absolutely wonderful observer. He did this wonderful bit of navigating. And then Bambi pulls my coat tail and he says, I forgot to tell you, I did not take my chart board with me. And I couldn't believe what he was telling me. In the panic, and the fact that we were all new, to climb into the aircraft on the deck, he completely left his chart board behind. And having got into the aircraft with all the propellers going and the whole flight deck geared up that day, he hadn't the heart to tell me that he'd left his chart board behind. So what did he do? It's a wonderful story, I think. In his pocket he found the last letter he'd got from his girlfriend, who became his wife later. He always had the letters. And he got the envelope of this and he tore it flat. And he found a stubby old bit of pencil in his jacket pocket. And he carried out all his navigation on this bit of back of an envelope with a stubby pencil, and sort of measuring with his finger like this the distances, and he was absolutely spot on. And he told me this, and of course I started shouting out all round the wardroom, "My observe, he doesn't need a chart, well, he does all this, you see." And everybody was agog. About a quarter of an hour later, there's a pipe comes over the loudspeakers. Midshipman Brooke to report to Commander Ops in his cabin at the double. So off goes Bambi to meet the observer Ops, who's the big white chief of all the observing. And he gets the biggest rocket he'd ever had in his life. Bambi being Bambi thought, "Oh, I'm the cock of the walk, I can do it." And of course the chief observer, Commander O, said, "You've jeopardised the life of your crew, you've jeopardised the life of one of Her Majesty's aircraft, you're an absolute disgrace." And he said, "I've a mind to get you slung off this ship, I don't want you here behaving like this," but he said, "I'll give you one more chance," and he said, "and you'll be duty officer for the next week or something." And there was me, I thought I'd got a